Blackstone Audiobooks presents Savannah by James Reisner. The following dedication appears in the book. For the members of the Western Pulp's email group, especially the real Captain Jim. Chapter 1. Blistering sun, dust that clogged the nose and throat, rocks that gouged the flesh and hid venomous snakes, pelting rain that was a relief from the heat but brought with it thick, clinging mud, and the memories that clung to a man's mind as tenaciously as the mud stuck to his feet. With a ringing shout from thousands of throats, the Yankees surged up Missionary Ridge, and the ragged gray men of the South were forced before them. Surrounded by clouds of acrid powder smoke, with the wind rip of bullets around their heads and the thunder of bursting shells pounding at their ears, the Confederates could stand no longer against the Northern horde. They broke and fled, and the Yankees howled and nipped at their heels like the ravening beasts they were. And what should have been a sorely needed victory was only another defeat, one more of a series that had torn the heart and soul out of the fledgling nation known as the Confederate States of America.
"Here, bust a tooth on this. Corey, can you hear me? You all right?"
Corey Brannan blinked and shook his head. The recollections of Chattanooga faded. He looked over at Abner Strayhorn, who held out a piece of hardtack. Corey took the square of almost impossibly tough bread. "Thanks," he said, and slipped it into his shirt pocket. Tall, skinny, and sunburned, with a shock of unruly red hair, Strayhorn frowned.
"Ain't you gonna eat?"
"Not now," Corey said. "I'm not very hungry."
"Best to eat whilst you got the chance. Don't never know when them damn Yankees will show up again."
Strayhorn was right, but Corey didn't have any appetite. He shifted, trying to find a more comfortable position in the rocks among which the two men sat. That was impossible, of course. No place on Rocky Face Ridge was comfortable. These days, no place in the whole Confederacy can make that claim, Corey thought. Nearly 6 months had passed since the defeat at Chattanooga. May 1864 found the Army of Tennessee, now no longer commanded by the temperamental and irascible Braxton Bragg, but rather guided by the genial and professional Joseph E. Johnston, ensconced at Dalton, Georgia, and across the broad valley surrounding the town. To the west was Rocky Face, 800 feet high and 20 miles long, where the Confederate line looked down upon the neighboring valley the Federal Army would have to traverse before it could reach Johnston's men. The tracks of the Western and Atlantic Railroad angled across the valley and curved through a gap in Rocky Face on their way to Dalton, where they turned south toward Resaca and ultimately Atlanta. After being forced to retreat from Missionary Ridge the previous November, the Southerners had pulled back into northwestern Georgia. Rumors flying among the dispirited soldiers had it that the retreat would not stop until they had run all the way to Atlanta. But Bragg, whose handling of the army had proven disastrous for the Confederacy yet again, called a halt at Dalton so the men could rest. Nearly everyone believed that the Yankees were right on their heels, but some scouting missions by the cavalry revealed that was not the case. For whatever reason, the Federals had held back, so Bragg stayed at Dalton, waiting to see what was going to happen next. What happened was that he was replaced as the commander of the Army of Tennessee. Johnston assumed the command, and he immediately set out to get his army ready for a renewed assault by the Yankees. It was inconceivable that, having won Tennessee, the Northerners would stop now. To the south lay Atlanta, a rail and supply center that would surely be an irresistibly tempting target for the Federals. Johnston began by reorganizing the army into three corps. Two infantry corps, under Generals William J. Hardee and John Bell Hood, and a cavalry corps commanded by General Joseph Wheeler. Reorganizing a defeated army was one thing. Raising its spirits was something entirely different. Johnston succeeded at the former and struggled with the latter. But although few were ready to give up, the tens of thousands of men who were arrayed atop Rocky Face knew that the odds were against them. The Yankees, it was said, had 100,000 men in Chattanooga now, and they were led by the fierce General William Tecumseh Sherman. Ulysses S. Grant, who had won the victory at Chattanooga with Sherman's help, had gone to Washington to assume overall command of the Union forces and bedevil General Robert E. Lee in Virginia. Grant would find wily old Marse Robert a tougher nut to crack than Bragg had been, the Confederate soldiers told themselves. In the meantime, the Southerners would have to deal sooner or later with Sherman, so they kept a close eye on the valley west of Rocky Face. That was the way Sherman would come at them. Back in February, there had been a minor battle in this spot, as the Federals sent a small force against the ridge to probe the Confederate line, then pull back. Since then, there had been only occasional sniping. Corey used the sleeve of his shirt to wipe sweat from his forehead. Only a week into May, and already the weather was hot. Still, many of the men were glad summer was on the horizon. The winter had been wet, cold, and miserable. Threadbare blankets and ragged uniforms provided little protection against the chill. Many of the men no longer had shoes or boots and had to wrap rags around their feet in an attempt to keep their toes from freezing off. Corey was lucky in that respect. His shoes had a few small holes in them, but they were intact for the most part. At least he had shoes. That was more than most could say, including Abner Strayhorn, who stretched out his legs in front of him and wiggled his toes in the sunlight.
"Well, that feels good," Abner said, around a mouthful of hardtack. "I remember when I was a boy running barefoot, through the grass and soaking my feet in the creek. I never did like shoes much."
"You'll wish we had some when we go to marching again," Corey said. Abner laughed.
"Yeah, more than likely. But I don't reckon we'll be pulling out of here anytime soon. The old general, he likes to sit. So we sit. Make the damn Yankees come to us."
That would happen, Corey thought, and probably sooner rather than later. Even now it was easy to gaze off to the north and west from the heights of Rocky Face and imagine a haze of dust floating in the air, dust raised by wagon wheels, and the hooves of the mules and horses pulling those vehicles, and the feet of tens of thousands of blue-clad Yankee soldiers. Only he was not imagining it. Corey realized as he sat up straighter and reached for his rifle lying on the rocky ground beside him. There really was a lot of dust over there, and that much dust could mean only one thing. "They're coming," he said. Abner wasn't paying any attention. He and Corey had been friends for several months, and Corey knew that the lanky Tennessean had a tendency to drift off into a world of his own, even when he was on guard duty and was supposed to be watching for the enemy. "Yankees," Corey said, louder this time.
"Huh? What are you saying, Corey?"
Leveling his arm and pointing, Corey said, "Look over there! The Yankees are coming!" Strayhorn's eyes widened in surprise as he looked where Corey was indicating.
"Some bitch! There's so much dust, there must be a whole blamed army over there!"
Yes, the Union Army, Corey thought. But he didn't say that. There was no point in making Abner feel foolish. Picking up his rifle, Corey scrambled to his feet. He brushed rock dust off the seat of his trousers. "I'll go tell the lieutenant. He may know about it already." Abner nodded.
"I'll stay right here and keep an eye on those old boys. Y'all heard back, Corey."
The two of them were posted atop a sheer cliff, known as Buzzard's Roost, that overlooked Mill Creek Gap, through which the railroad tracks ran. Confederate engineers had constructed dams to block the flow of the creek and flood much of the gap. The area that was left open was guarded by earthworks and overlooked by dozens of artillery batteries and a strong force on top of the flanking heights. Large boulders littered the ridge and provided good cover. If the Yankee infantry came, the gap's defenders would have plenty of shelter and a good place from which to fire back at the northern invaders. If the Federals targeted the batteries on the gap instead, well then the rocks wouldn't help the men above. The exploding shells would blow them to hell. As he hurried across the broad, fairly level top of the ridge, Corey hoped that the Yankees sent the infantry first. He wanted to have a fighting chance. That was all the Confederacy had ever asked, he thought. Lieutenant Edward Stockard was in charge of the detail manning Buzzard's Roost. He was in his mid-20s, not much older than Corey, but in this war, which had cost the lives of so many gallant soldiers, some men in their 20s were colonels, or even generals. Stockard stood at the eastern crest of the ridge, balancing himself precariously on top of a boulder and squinting through a spyglass. He lowered the glass and looked down at Corey. "I see him, Private Brannan," he said before Corey could speak. With a curt motion, he closed the spyglass into a short tube. "We knew the Yankees would come visiting sooner or later." "Yes, sir," Corey said. "What do you want us to do, Lieutenant?" Stockard smiled. "Give our guests a warm welcome, Mr. Brannan. A most warm welcome." Corey nodded and turned to hurry back to the other side of the ridge. Stockard's response was just about what he had expected. It still sounded odd sometimes, though, to hear somebody address him as Private Brannan. Corey had fought at Forts Henry and Donelson and at the little country church near Pittsburgh Landing, known as Shiloh. Had raided into western Tennessee with the cavalry under the incomparable Nathan Bedford Forrest. Had slipped into Memphis on a desperate, dangerous mission as a spy. And had taken part in the valiant but doomed defense of Vicksburg. But he had done those things as a civilian, not a real soldier. Not until the previous autumn had he sworn the oath and joined the Confederate Army. A part of him still wished he hadn't. Then he would be free to go where he pleased, to pick his own fights. After the battle along Chickamauga Creek, he could have gone west with Forrest, who had befriended him what seemed a lifetime ago at Shiloh. The general was back in Tennessee now, Corey had heard, raising hell with the Yankee supply lines. But even as those thoughts went through his head, Corey knew he couldn't have left, whether or not he was in the Army officially. Colonel Charles Thompson, one of his best friends and the uncle of Corey's beloved wife, Lucille, had been wounded at Chickamauga. Corey couldn't have ridden off and left him in the field hospital.